Macro Voices is pleased to bring you this encore presentation of an interview which originally aired in full color video on Real Vision Television at an earlier date. Real Vision is a paid subscription video on demand channel for finance. In partnership with Real Vision Television, we are pleased to offer Macro Voices subscribers a free trial subscription to Real Vision. To sign up, go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices. Meanwhile, please enjoy this encore presentation of Real Vision content.
Hello, I'm Nathan Egger from Macro Voices. For this week's Real Vision Encore presentation, we're bringing you an interview from mid-September 2015 featuring Fred Hickey. Mr. Hickey got started working for General Telephone Electronics for 10 years before beginning to write the High Tech Strategist newsletter, which he has now written for 28 years. Mr. Hickey has over 36 years deeply involved in technology, both on the business side and as an investor. Other subjects he's going to talk to you about will be gold, the Fed, and the mispricing of everything. But above all, I think you'll find that he brings a unique level of insight into the differences between the tech world today and times gone by. I hope you all enjoy this week's Real Vision Television Encore presentation.
I'm here with Fred Hickey, a man I've been wanting to talk to for a long time. Fred, thank you for inviting me to your beautiful home out in the countryside in New Hampshire. It's a real pleasure for me to be sitting here talking to you today.
Oh, glad to have you here.
Now, there's so much stuff I want to talk to you about, but I think for those viewers who aren't familiar with the work you do, perhaps you could just give a little bit of your background and then we can talk technology and gold mining and all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see. Where do I start? I worked in industry for 10 years within a company called General Telephone Electronics. And I was in finance as well as I did a lot of EDP, as we called it back then, EDP work. And my last job there, I had various roles. My last job there was a controller over a printed circuit board facility. We also had a clean room, which 2.0 micron, not nano net, the 2.0 micron clean room. I spent 10 years there. Five of them, I started writing a newsletter, and that was the newsletter called The High Tech Strategist, that I've now been writing for 28 years. So I've been out on my own now for over 20 years, and I had written 5 years just for friends and family. I had had a love of the stock market that started when I was fairly young. My dad was a hobbyist in the market. And I grew up in Lowell, Massachusetts, and that was the home of Wang Labs. And when I lived there, Wang Labs was growing like Topsy. And I'd see these buildings piling up. And I went out to school. I went to Notre Dame in Indiana. And I got out of school. And while I was in school, I watched these buildings. I watched Wang Labs become one of the largest minicomputer companies in that minicomputer craze. And I said, if I ever had any money, which I didn't at the time, I would put money into that kind of company. And I did, as soon as I got out of school and got a job. I started buying my first shares of a technology company, Wang Labs, and in that first year, it tripled. And I also bought Prime Computer, which was nearby, and that was another major minicomputer company, and that quadrupled. And I said, you know, even though I had 10 shares of things and 15 shares, I said, this is great. This is something I really would like to get involved in. And so I did, and I found out it was a little bit more difficult than that over time. That was in the late 1970s, 1979. So I've been doing this now for a very long time. 36 years I've been deeply involved in technology, but writing the newsletter for 28 years. I started writing the letter because I was moving around within GTE. And I had these followers. I was doing fairly well. I continued to have success, but not the same kind of success that I had with the initial Wang Labs and Prime Computer purchases. But I continued to have success, and as I would move around the country with GTE or move to different locations, I had some followers just wanted to know what I was doing. Because I was doing all this work on the side. I was doing all this research. I was going into Connecticut, for example, into Westport's library when I lived down there, and I would spend time in the library reading all the trade magazines and technology trade magazines. or when I lived around in Massachusetts, I would be at Lowell Technological Institute's library, and I'd be the only Caucasian in there with a bunch of Asians, Indians, and all sorts of people, but I would be in there reading all the trade magazines. For at the time, it was a great PC, you know, mostly it was a PC world that was really taking off. So I was reading all of that kind of thing. So I continued on. I had people that were following me. My wife, well, we lived in Connecticut in the mid-80s, and I had looked into Wall Street, but at the time I was making good money and had great benefits from GTE, and it was difficult for me to take a step down into an early job in Wall Street. My wife said, you know, someday you'll be able to do it on your own. I said, well, maybe. And she said, plus I don't like the area. So I decided not to go to Wall Street, and I took a job back here within GTE. And in 1987, she bought me a computer, a laptop that weighed 40 pounds, bought me a computer, bought me a printer, said, you can write, and all these people want you to do this. Why don't you start writing this letter? So she's responsible for this, for what we have today in terms of the newsletter, and as widespread as it is. And I started writing it in 1987 on the side. And the GT people were very happy to allow me to do that. I did that for 5 years, just for friends and family and associates within GTE. I continued to have success in investing in tech stocks. The best time for me came in 1990, when I was able to buy things for just dirt cheap, cash value. I mean, I remember one software company that was cash value, no debt, was a leader in its field. I could buy it for literally nothing, and I did. And so I bought all those, a bunch of different tech stocks. There was Software Publishing and all sorts of names of Ashton Tate, companies that go way back. And they exploded in price in 1990 and 1991. We bottomed, and it was a small bear market, but a huge bear market in tech. And I made a lot of money. And at that point, I said, I'm going to try to do this newsletter thing. I'll go out on my own. At that time, though, the newsletter had gotten around to people I didn't know. It had gone to friends of friends, one of whom was a CFO at a technology company. And he sent my newsletter into a boutique brokerage house in Boston called Fechter Detweiler, and now it's Detweiler Mitchell, I think it is. It's fairly well-known boutique for technology. And they had seen the letter and said, they heard I was leaving GT, and they said, please come in. We'd like you to be a tech analyst. So I said, I went in for an interview with them, and we hit it off. The director, I hit it off instantly with him. And he offered me a job, and I went to work as one of their technology analysts for a very brief time. The reason why I thought it would be great, they would pay me to do the research that I was doing on weekends and nights for all these years and in the libraries and all of that. They were going to pay me to do what I love to do and to discover all of these technology nuggets, you know, great companies that might be undervalued for whatever reason. They were going to do that. Well, the problem was that I was in great demand when I went in there, and the institutional salesman decided they would bring me to New York and to Boston, all the big brokerage firms, not the brokerage firms, the mutual fund firms and the hedge funds, to try to sell the experience that I had built up, the expertise. The retail broker people wanted me to talk to wanted me to put out reports that they sell for the retail people. And their investment banking people were trying to get me to go to get merger and acquisition types of clients. So I found myself at the end of the day doing no research whatsoever. And I said, I can't do this. I'm getting stupider by the minute here, the longer I sit here. So they didn't want me to leave. I did. And then I finally went out on my own. And then over time, it just blossomed. Now, one of the benefits of being in that brokerage firm for that brief period of time, it was only a matter of months, was that they introduced me to all sorts of people in Boston and New York, and those people wanted to be subscribers of the letter. So it grew on its own without any advertising for all this time. We've never advertised. And it is what it is now. So that's a long story of how this newsletter became.
Well, the thing that attracted me to your writing initially, apart from countless recommendations from people, was just the way you think, and I think that some of it came across in that story. You're a very pragmatic thinker. You don't get swept up in the hype and the promise and all the stuff that makes the stock market tick. You take a very cold, hard look at stuff, and you're not afraid to make calls based on reality. I mean, that must have, over the life of the high-tech strategies, that must have been a really difficult thing to do in the tech industry particularly, where that hyperbole is everywhere.
It helps being out of the mainstream.
Yeah.
It's great being in New Hampshire. So, you know, I'm not in Boston or New York, not in the day-to-day pressures. I'm not managing other people's money, which makes a big difference. I've turned down countless offers to either manage big funds' money or to manage other people's money. I never wanted to do that because I didn't want to ruin a good thing. My good thing is that I do have this independent, unemotional look that is very, I consider it to be rare, and I think my subscribers appreciate it as well. This rare, honest look at how I see the world, and I think that has a lot to do with the success of the letter, is that I'm completely independent.
Yeah, you have this knack of, whenever I read your letter, you basically lay out the world as you see it at the beginning of each letter. And every time you write, it's so succinct and so to the point, and you manage to crystallize all the various tides that are kind of pulling at everything and put them into three paragraphs. That's a real skill to be able to distill everything that's going on right now into a short factual piece.
Well, I thank you for that. I think that has to do with how the process that I have to go through to get there. And I know I only have a certain amount of space. And I also know that, you know, I was an analyst for a while, and you're responsible for a certain number of companies that you follow. And that's the case wherever you are on Wall Street. You're a semiconductor analyst. There's a computer analyst over here. There's a communications guy over here, a mobile guy over here. Your world is small. But I knew that from experience, as an investor, the world is big, and you can't ignore macro kinds of pressures that are out there, forces. You have to understand competitive forces. You have to understand all of these kinds of things to be able to make a decision about an individual stock or an industry. And so you can't just ignore it and just have blinders on. You have to consider it all. So I try to do that, but then I have to do it in a relatively small amount of space. And so it forces you to think concisely. And so I try to think, what are the big macro? What are the big macro forces that are out there? And how will it affect market prices? And what's going on in the global economy? And then I work my way down to then the individual areas.
So if we go back to the first big tech bubble in the late 90s. You were that guy. You were the guy that CNBC always wanted to come on so the bulls could poke fun at you and laugh.
I knew better.
Yeah, right. But you stayed the course and you said, look, there's no sensation. This is what I see. It's going to end in tears. And of course it did. We all know what happened there. Right. When you look at what's going on now, do you see more parallels or more differences than when you compare it to the late 90s?
I see parallels and I see differences. The parallels are that we have the second highest market valuations in the history of the country here, second only to that 2000 bubble period. On some measurements, it's even higher now. On a median stock base, it's higher in some cases. What's different is it's broader. Instead of just a TMT bubble, and that's what it was. There were opportunities for investors and to buy other stocks at a relatively reasonable price back in the late 1990s and 2000 timeframe. You could do that. You could also get 6%, and I was hiding in 6% treasury short term then, which seems almost impossible now that we've had 9 years of 0% interest rates. But there were 6% short term yields for treasuries that I could hide in, and people thought that was crazy. The bubbles are broader. We have a bubble in biotech going on at the same time. We have a bubble in what they call unicorn stocks. We have 100 plus of those that are over $1 billion. Some of them are tens of billions of dollars. And most of these are startup companies, and they have unproven business models. And that's very similar to what we saw with the Webvans and the pet.coms of the world back in 2000. That's similar. But we didn't have a biotech bubble going on at the same time. And we have real estate bubble in certain parts of the country and world now. We have artwork bubble. We have bubbles, and you could argue that a bond market's in a bubble. Certainly prices aren't reasonable because they're suppressed. So it's so much broader. It's so much bigger. We're so much deeper into this experiment, this experiment with Keynesian experiment of managing economies and managing markets and managing prices than we were back then. Back then, it was a precursor of what was to come. The Fed had, Alan Greenspan had done a little bit of money printing in order to save us from Y2K, the great Y2K problem that turned out not to be, and I knew that was not going to be, but there was a little bit of that, and that was enough to kick off that bubble that had been building for some years. And then we had easy money as well, easy credit. So this one's much bigger. It's much more dangerous, I think, than even then. It maybe more not more dangerous to than it, the 100%, 90% declines that we saw in many of the tech stocks individually, but it's much more, it's also more global, I think, than it, this is more of a global problem that we have today than it was. It was more concentrated in the U.S.
When you look at what you do, and you start in the technology world, mm-hmm. and you build your way up, and you go through all these companies making very specific things and addressing very specific markets. Mm-hmm. Eventually, you find yourself looking at monetary policy, which is not something I'm sure you had to do in the 90s.
Even. I didn't. No.
Now it's almost you can take someone who is at the very top of their particular field, like you in the tech world. You can't ignore decisions being made about the inputs of monetary policy. How do you deal with that when you have to throw in this X factor that you've never had to, in all your experience, you've never had to think about before, and suddenly you not only have to think about it, but it has to be the single biggest input into every decision you make on a company?
One of the things to consider is that the tech world was much smaller back in the 70s, 80s. We were talking about relatively, computers were much more immature. They weren't as embedded into the economy as they are today, where you know corporations can't live without them. Back when I first was starting in GTE and some of those places, they were still doing, keeping inventory by hand in paper. So it really was immature at the time, and now it's much larger. So it's technology is market is buffeted by economic forces more than it was back then. We're talking 1.4 billion smartphones sold every year, 300 million PCs. It's just staggering kinds of numbers that we weren't talking back in the late 1970s, 1980s. So it's much bigger. But then in addition to that, it's less of a free market than it used to be. There's much more government intervention. We didn't have Fed members dominating the news flow as we do today. Back in the 70s, 80s, you'd barely get an utterance out of Paul Volcker. We used to have to wait for money supply numbers on Thursday afternoon, to get any sense as to what they might be doing. Here we have a Fed governor speaking every other day, and they're media stars, and they're affecting the markets. That never occurred back then. It's a totally different world than when I started. And I find it frustrating because prices aren't accurate as a result of all the intervention, of all the 0% interest rates, the trillions of dollars of money printed around the world. Asset prices aren't real, and other prices aren't as well. So it affects my ability to find those nuggets of the tech that kept me going to the libraries to try to find back in the 70s and 80s to try to find those great opportunities. They're not there right now because asset prices are lifted so high, and they're dangerous. We saw what happened in 2000. Tech stocks lost $5 trillion worth of market valuation. And we saw companies like WorldCom lose 100% of their valuation. Others, Suns and EMCs and Cisco's 90, 95% plus. And then we saw what happened in 2008, where the stocks got cut in half in a year, and tech stocks did even worse than that. Semiconductor stocks lost 2/3 of their value. And here we are again. My hands, I feel frustrated that my hands are tied. I don't have a normal market. I don't have normal prices. And I know there's a lot of danger out there. So it's not what I signed up to do initially.
But can we ever have normal prices again? I mean, does it take a massive clearing event for that to happen? Or do we now have to, I mean, as you've had to do, is adapt from a very individual look at equities and companies and the underpinnings of them, do we all have to adapt now to the fact that we're not going to see normal pricing again and we have to, this X factor is always going to be there?
Well, I think what we've had is this great monetary experiment, this great Keynesian experiment here where these central bankers think that they can manage prices properly. And I keep hoping that this experiment will be seen as a failure. It's funny, the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago had a story on that, an editorial talking about the failure of the Fed follies. And they showed all of their forecasts and how wrong they've been every year, and how they've been expecting this escape velocity to occur ever since they started printing money in 2009. And here we are, six, 7 years later, and we're still at 0% interest rates, never mind trying to exit from all of the $3.7 trillion of money they printed. I think we're getting closer to the moment where people are starting to question this great money printing experiment. And my hope is that it will be seen as a failure ultimately, and that we will eventually see market prices again, the market pricing assets again, as they do so efficiently. And when they do that as well, the economy will likely lift. We won't have the worst economic recovery in history, in the last 70 years at least, which is half a percentage point worse than any other recovery, despite all the intervention. They've caused all sorts of problems here. Money is allocated inefficiently. We see money going to these unicorns. We see money going to the biotech. Any biotech company can get funding because of the amount of liquidity that's out there. And we've seen money go into what I call into a data center kind of overbuild, similar to the fiber optic and capacity build that I warned about in advance back in 2000. It's just craziness. And we're seeing the same kind of thing where people are building out cloud infrastructure way beyond what will be needed. So we have all this malinvestment that goes on, and as a result of that, the economy never gets going. We also creates wealth inequality, and the average person here thinks that, well, IBD, Investor Business Daily tip poll came out last week, and 46% of Americans think we're in a recession. 66% of Trump supporters think we're in a recession. And two-thirds in a different polls, two-thirds of the people think, U.S. people think that we're headed in the wrong direction in this country, and they're right. They're all right. We may not be an official recession, but they're all right. We're all heading in the wrong direction where the economy is a mess, wages aren't growing, yet cost of living are, and it's causing all of these problems, including wealth inequality, that potentially could cause social problems. And so my hope is that all of these problems are building and building and building, and then eventually the Fed will be seen for what they are, which are interventionists, which are basically Keynesian socialists. And we don't want that in this country. The Fed was initiated 100 years ago, and they had to go to Jekyll Island in disguise in order to try to get the plan going to bring a central bank here. To this country, and they found a congressional period where there weren't a lot of people in there, and they snuck it through. But they snuck it through with a bunch of rules that said they would never get involved in the kinds of things they're doing today. And here we are. So I'm hopeful that we finally do get that cathartic cleansing that we do need, and that market pricing returns, and that I can do the work that I love to do.
Well, I mean, we had that cathartic cleansing in 99, 2000. We had it again in 2008.
But we didn't.
Right.
We exactly. didn't, because we had collapses in the stock market prices, but the Fed came back in each instance with even more. Back in after 2000, all they did was lower rates to historic low of 1%. And that was enough to kick off then the housing bubble and all the other bubbles that we had there, the credit bubble as well, eventually. Then when that crashed in 2008, they came in with even more. 1% rates weren't enough, so they went to zero. And then we had QE1, and then we had even a larger QE2, and then we had the unlimited QE, QE3, which was $1.7 trillion. If somebody had told me that, 10, 15 years ago that our country would be printing money like this, I wouldn't believe it. Yet here we are. So we've never, even then, we had these great stock collapses, but valuations, even during those periods, never hit the kind of lows that you usually see. Usually see single-digit PEs. Usually see dividend yields that are high. We never did that. So while the losses were tremendous, they were never to the extent that you ever got a complete cleansing.
So if we come back to what you do, we get back to the tech stocks and analyzing them from the ground up. Mm-hmm. And particularly I'm interested in you seem to have taken a much more tactical approach, mm-hmm. which I guess is a response to this interference where you right. can't actually invest. You have to kind of trade now. It's difficult to invest. Right. What are you seeing in the tech sector specifically right now that tactically you think people should be aware of?
Well, I think, unfortunately, the market's been driven by money printing. So we were in that great decline in 2008, and stocks fell 50% in a little over a year's time, and tech stocks did worse than that. Semiconductors fell 60, 70% declines, and we never got a complete cleansing there. and then QE1 came in. Bernanke announced that, and the markets lifted. They lifted immediately. They soared. And as soon as QE1 ended in 2010, the market fell. Stocks fell. They declined 1,400 points, 13%. And that caused the Fed to come in and do QE2. And that went on for a period of time and then into 2011. When that ended, stocks fell again. This time they fell 2,000 points. They fell 16%. That was the last correction that we had prior to the most recent one. And then every time they would come in, the stocks would soar. Every time QE was initiated, stocks would soar. Every time it ended, stocks would decline. So after a while, you see this enough, you say, I can't fight money. I can't fight monetary printing, money printing. With QE3, it was so large that I said, I can't short. You can't short. You can't short when all asset prices are being lifted. And that's when I talk about guerrilla warfare. I went in there and I started saying, well, there's problems in the economy, so I can find tech stocks that are overvalued, and if they miss numbers, then I can tactically do shorts only through put options because I don't want to expose myself for any length of time. And so I was doing some of that in the tech world. In 2008, after that, I bought. I got rid of all my put options in 2008, in October of 2008. I sold them all, and then I went long. And I held on to those things not long enough. The longest one I held for 4 years, that was Microsoft. But others I sold, or they got bought out. And then I was just doing tactical shorting. Now, however, QE3 ended. And I said, okay, QE3 ends. What's going to happen here? Well, I know what's going to happen. The economy hasn't improved at all. It's worse than it was. The market is going to fall. It's going to break down again. And so as a result of that, last year I started not just tactically, what I call guerrilla warfare, going in and out of any kinds of short selling. Here I took bigger positions, a little bigger. Not as big as I did in 2000 or even in 2008. But here I took more longer term positions against areas that I knew that were in trouble. And I get into those after here. But I started being aggressive really in October of last year, right as QE3 was ending. And since that time, it's taken a while for the market to break down, but breakdown it has. We saw the transports roll over. They peaked in November. We saw the utilities roll over, and they peaked in January. The Dow peaked, hit 18,000 for the first time in December. We were 15,000 just a couple of weeks ago during that little mini crash that we had on Monday, October 24th. Big decline. internals. I was writing about how the market internals were breaking down. Advanced declines were worsening. New highs and lows were worsening. Junk bond market broke down. Commodity prices collapsed. Oil prices dropped by 50%. No QE. Asset prices fall. And that provided an opportunity for me to get a little more aggressive on the short side, particularly in what I thought in the PC market, where not only did they have the problem of no QE, but they also had a short-term blip up in sales in the PC market as a result of the ending of Microsoft's Windows XP support in April of 2014. And I knew that created a short-term refresh upcycle that got everyone excited about the resurgence of PCs that I knew wasn't accurate. And so that lifted all kinds of prices of PC-related stocks like Micron and like the disk drive company Seagate and Western Digital, Intel, which was in the 30s, Western Digital was over 100, all these kinds of things. And I started shorting them through put options there. And now I'm doing less of that, although still Intel. I think they'll miss the quarter. I can get into detail if you'd like on that. You want me to do that here? I can do that here.
No, absolutely, because I'm fascinated by this. Because again, this is just yet more example of just this real world. It's more critical thinking than investing. I mean, as you said, the end of XP support, everybody knows about that, and yet people throw that out. They get goosed by the fact that the numbers are going up, and that's the thing they focus on.
Right, and part of the problem was to get goosed because we were still in the money printing environment. The money printing environment makes everything pretty. So as prices are going up, they lose sight of the fact that there are real long-term problems in the PC market. So what's happened is the PC sales last quarter were down 10 or 11% year over year, big decline. And there's some long-term structural problems in the PC market where we have smartphones that are becoming more of the computer, information at your fingertips. People are relying more on smartphones, some tablets, not as much, but really smartphones become the go-to device for most people. So PCs are being undermined a bit by that, and then they have the Windows problem. And then also you have a slowdown in the world economy, the global economy. All of these factors are coming together to cause trouble for PC companies, and it showed up as this big decline here. Now we're back into deep double-digit declines. Last month, IDC came out and said that they didn't see a pickup now until 2017. Hewlett-Packard came out with their numbers 2 weeks ago and admitted that there wouldn't be any kind of a pickup for several quarters. There's great inventory surge out there. As a result of the slowdown in sales that wasn't expected this year, you have a big inventory buildup. And I was just reading yesterday out of Asia that there's so much inventory for notebooks in Europe that they're actually giving one free for every two you buy. Some of the resellers are in such trouble that they're actually asking for financing from the PC vendors themselves. And then I was looking at you can see you have to get into the channels and find out what's going on, and a lot of it's in Asia, and so I read Asian online types.
But this used to be called research, right?
This is all research.
This is research.
So this is what I was doing yesterday, for example, picking up information that the August shipments out of the largest computer manufacturers were down 17% year over year. Now they were up 10% from. Here's a great example of what a little bit of knowledge and a lot of knowledge is. There's differences, okay? Recently, there's been excitement on Wall Street. There's been chatter, and Intel's been rising because there's been some chatter that PC sales have picked up. That was the word. PC sales have picked up. And it was chatter out of Asia, and there's chatter out in the United States. PC sales have picked up. And I said, I'm not buying that. I don't understand why it would. I don't know why it would when I know the global economy is weakening. There's your big picture look at the world as well, which we get into. I don't know why it would. There's no catalysts here. Windows 10 is actually thought to be a deterrent to PC buying because you can get Windows 10 free now, so you don't necessarily have to go out and get a new computer. And Gartner has come out and said that they think it will actually cause sales to slow down. And that's one of the reasons why IDC and why Hewlett-Packard don't see any pickup. I don't know why there would be, but I do know seasonally that there is a pickup. There's an inventory build program that goes on for the latter half of the year. And in addition to that, you do have some Windows 10 purchases. And I also know that the inventory that's out there is Windows 8 related, that they haven't been able to sell. So it's no surprise to me that that we're seeing, that we saw a pickup sequentially from June to July or July to August, just because that's what always happens and just because people need Windows 10 machines. But that's not telling you that the PC market has improved. Well, here, everybody gets all excited. They start buying Intel again, driving up close to 30 and buying, and rumors about better numbers from the PC market. I didn't buy it. Well, what did I see yesterday out of Taiwan? The Taiwanese did see a 10% improvement. The manufacturer, all the large manufacturers over there, saw a 10% sequential month-to-month improvement. And that was the headline. Look a little closer. It was down 17% year over year. It's even worse than what was going on in the second quarter. And yet now they've marked up prices again. So what did I do? Well, I bought some Intel puts yesterday, right? Because I know that the PC market is no good. And in Intel's case specifically, they have a very optimistic viewpoint of the second half. It was one of the strongest first to second half improvements that they've had in years forecasted. In addition to that, last quarter they earned 55 cents a share. They beat estimates. But they beat estimates with a 9% tax rate, and they had been running at a 26-27% tax rate. Well, what's their forecast for the tax rate? It was a one-time event. It was a decision they made to do it that quarter. Had they not, they would have missed numbers significantly. Did any of the headlines in any of the papers pick up that they had missed numbers significantly? No, they didn't. They said Intel beats numbers. The computers that read headlines, they said Intel beats numbers, buy Intel. Well, the reality was they missed numbers by a lot. And now they have a forecast of 55 cents again this quarter, yet they're going to have a regular tax rate of 26%. And we have this PC decline that's going on where Windows 10 is causing people to slow sales. We have all this inventory built up all over the world for PCs. And in Intel's case alone, they also have an inventory problem, which eventually, I mean, last quarter, their inventory was up 22% year over year to $4.6 billion on a 5% revenue decline. Eventually, they're going to have to cut back production. They're going to have to cut back capital spending even more than they already have this year. They've cut it back significantly. They have to cut it back, and that will lead the margins to fall, and they won't make their estimates. I don't think they'll make them this year, this quarter, and they won't make them in Q4 either. So that means that there's likely to be another miss. We see that regularly with Intel because they're just, I don't want to call them hopeless optimists, but they are optimists. And I've been following Intel for close to 30 years, and seems like they miss every other quarter almost.
Right. But they don't seem to really get punished that bad. And that, I guess that's part of the dangers of this QE environment.
That's right. But we don't have any QE. And as I said, as soon as the QE ended, we saw in QE1, we saw a big decline, double-digit decline, QE2 decline. And then we've seen the breakdown of the market that began in December and really showed itself in the last couple of weeks, when the market plunged and we had a 1,000-point decline on worries about the global economy. And so QE isn't there in the United States, and that means that United States stocks are vulnerable. And so we're seeing that decline. And I think that we're likely to continue this decline. September, October are periods that historically where we have our come-to-Jesus moments in the markets. And we have big declines. And as you watch this deterioration occur, I think we're likely head into a bear market. Now, it won't be the kind of bear market that we've had in 2000, where tech stocks were slaughtered, or in 2008, because I think they hadn't discovered QE at the time. Now they have. And I don't think that, partly because the economy is so weak, that they can allow a major decline in the market when it's about the only success that they've had. The only success they've had is to mark up prices and to create $30 trillion of wealth to $85 trillion. They've created $30 trillion of wealth, yet the economy is the weakest in history. Something's very wrong here. So they won't allow it. There'll be another quantitative easing. It'll be QE4. It will have to be huge. And it'll probably have to have some wrinkle to it. Maybe there'll be negative interest rates or something that will keep us from having a 40 or 50% kind of decline in the market. But we will get a bear market, and we're probably in it already. In fact, I'm fairly sure we're in it right now. And the only thing that can turn the markets these days is more Fed intervention, unfortunately. because they won't allow that. They won't allow the markets to clear. They won't allow them to get to prices where capitulation occurs and you've washed out sentiment. If we did that, we would have a terrible time. The economy is so weak, it would be the worst recession since the Great Depression. They won't allow that. They're still too enamored with the successes they've had, even though a lot of people, including the Wall Street Journal editorialist, didn't see that anymore. They're too enamored with it. And so they'll come in and do a QE4 as soon as there's enough screaming, as soon as there's enough bloodletting on Wall Street. They'll come in and do it again, and then we'll see what happens.
Well, they've kind of gone from they won't let it happen to now they can't let it happen. I mean, the stakes are, seems to me, far too high now.
Yeah, and the debt levels keep building up.
Yeah.
I mean, we're 40%, you know, the McKinsey report showed that we went up 40% from the 2008 time frame to $200 trillion around the world. I mean, in the United States, we've increased our government public debt, doubled it to $18.4 trillion from $9 trillion or so back then. So when you build up these debts, we're almost at a point of no turning back. It's kind of scary that we're at a point of no turning back. Do you want to be in a technology world right now when valuations are the second highest in history and you're seeing collapses around the world of the world economy and it requires money printing to keep it up? No, you don't want to be there. Now, as soon as I see QE, as soon as I see the market have enough pain, there's enough bloodshed on there, and I can get any indication that there will be QE, I'll be out of my puts again. And I might even buy some calls, because I'll have no faith in the economy to really step in and be long stocks, tech stocks, like I am long gold stocks. You can see, this is walking through a minefield almost. You have to watch what the Fed's doing. I mean, you can't just be a semiconductor analyst. You know, I talked about being an analyst. You can't be a semiconductor analyst and not know what the Fed's doing these days. The Fed is driving, or central banks, utterances from the central banks.